Ladies and gentlemen, your conference call is about to begin. Here is your moderator, Mr. Raymond Ibrahim.
Thank you for joining us for another Middle East Forums conference call. Today we'll be speaking with Shannon Rossmiller, a former judge and a pioneer of cyber counterterrorism. Her work has actually led to the capture of several Al-Qaeda operatives. Among some of the things that she learned through her work is to spot the oftentimes subtle signs that accompany radicalism and extremism, especially here on American soil. In light of the recent Fort Hood massacre, spotting these signs has obviously become more important than ever, and she will be discussing some of this along with other important matters that involve radicalization. Thank you for joining us, Shannon. Please begin.
Thank you. I just want to talk today about the importance of understanding the Islamic radicalization threat as being one of the keys to our defeating radical Islam and all that encompasses. I really believe that if we can achieve a meaningful understanding of the radicalization process, it will go a long way in assisting authorities with identifying individuals at risk who present a threat before the threat materializes and any attack is executed. I decided I wanted to speak out about this issue following the Fort Hood attack because the importance of the radicalization process, I believe, played an important part with respect to Major Hassan and the Fort Hood attack. And it also went unnoticed and undealt with by the Army. And as a result, we lost 13 Americans that day. In this vein, following the successful prosecution in a high-profile terrorism case involving Army Specialist Ryan Anderson, who attempted to defect to Al-Qaeda and have his fellow tank crews killed back in Iraq back in 2004, I was asked to consult on a case study with the Department of Defense called the Radicalization of Members of the DOD. The purpose of the case study was to better understand the radicalization process under the umbrella of radical Islam by exploring the internal and external manifestations and the power of the underlying ideology. This process was intended to provide supervisors, colleagues, and other professionals within the DOD an ability to identify individuals whose behavior and other characteristics were indicative of radicalization in order to preempt any threats they might present. Although the study was completed and its findings were disseminated within the Department of Defense community as well as the intel community at large, back in April of 2008, for whatever reason, the Army did not follow the study's recommendations and findings with respect to Major Hassan. I also strongly believe that the doctrine of political correctness within the Army was one factor that also allowed Major Hassan's radicalization process to proceed uninhibited. However, had the Army followed the findings and recommendations of the study, I really believe the attack at Fort Hood may have been avoided. Now, I just want to go into a rough talk about the process of radicalization and some of the things that I've found over the years that constitute that process. The process of radicalization comprises internalizing a set of beliefs and a militant mindset that embraces violent jihad as the paramount test of one's conviction. Individuals generally appear to begin the radicalization process on their own. Invariably, as they progress through these stages of radicalization, they seek like-minded individuals, leading to the group process. However, the process of radicalization carries with it all the individual, subjective, and objective motives, expectations, convictions of the radicalized person. The perception of personal marginalization combined with perception of the Western double standards and foreign policy appear to play a crucial role in this process for those radicalized under radical Islam. Okay, there's also one thing that a phenomenon that's developed over the years, and we've kind of referred to it as the self-radicalization. And, you know, essentially that is available and enabled by the online materials that are disseminated by Al-Qaeda and its supporters. Self-radicalization really may begin the day an individual seeks out the jihadist websites for further understanding and indoctrination. In the physical world, would-be jihadists seek support among local jihadist mentors and like-minded fanatics. This is a group that currently possesses the biggest danger to the United States and the West, and it is a focus of the present case with Major Hassan. Radicalization often starts with individuals who are frustrated with their lives or with their politics of their home governments. These individuals ultimately seek other like-minded individuals to form a loose-knit group or social network to advance the cause and objectives of an ideology. Together, they progress through a series of events, realizations, and experiences that often culminate in the decision to commit a terrorist attack. Also, over the years, there's been six areas I've kind of found of human, you know, behavior that constitute and are indicative of the radicalization process, such as how rigidly the individual interprets his religion, who that person, that individual comes to trust or not trust, and why, and how this individual views the relationship between the West and Islam, and how this individual demonstrates low tolerance for religious deviance and interpretation of his religion, and as well as their attempts to impose their beliefs on others in furtherance of their objectives. The case that I mentioned in my opening, the case of Ryan Anderson, who is a Washington Army National Guardsman, that was a case I was personally involved with that amounted to the largest conviction for the United States in the War on Terror. And with that case, what we found in hindsight was a really good template that offered up some of the identifying criteria that Anderson went through in his radicalization process leading up to what caused him to take the actions that he took. After the Fort Hood case happened, as things started to come out in the news accounts and whatnot about the different red flags and warnings that were missed by the Army or overlooked, there were all kinds of characteristic things that were missed that the Army failed to act on. And one of the most disturbing items I found that was reported related that during a series of meetings among Army doctors and mental health professionals in the spring of 2008, through the spring of 2009, serious questions were raised about Major Hassan's mental health and his fitness to act as a psychiatrist treating vulnerable soldiers returning from the war zone. One of these officials even went so far as to state that he worried that if Hassan deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan, he might leak secret military information to Islamic terrorists or extremists. Another official reported that he wondered whether Hassan might be capable of committing something like fratricide, like the Muslim Army Sergeant Hassan Akbar had in March of 2003, just prior to our invasion of Iraq. Other accounts of radical behavior displayed by Major Hassan report that as early as 2008, the FBI and Army were aware of some of the violent rhetoric and developing jihadist sentiments he was openly expressing. However, there have also been firsthand reports by friends and colleagues of Major Hassan describing varying degrees of disturbing behavior he exhibited not only at work but in his personal life, while he was counseling soldiers at Walter Reed Medical Center. One thing that has become obvious, at least through what's been reported from the Hassan case to date, is as Major Hassan continued to journey down the path to radical Islam, the Army, I believe, with political correctness as its guide, simply ignored the glaringly obvious red flags that his behavior was demonstrating for fear that any inquiry into his behavior would take on the appearance of religious discrimination. However, each and every red flag raised by Hassan's supervisors and colleagues represented an opportunity where the Army could have taken proper action, and any one of these missed opportunities could have prevented the Fort Hood massacre. Now, with respect to the Anderson case, some of the similarities between the red flags that he displayed historically as compared to what has been reported with Major Hassan, the similarities of these red flags and warnings indicating a real and escalating threat in both cases. Especially with respect to the Hassan case, it's almost chilling how similar these two cases are. In the Anderson case, although colleagues and fellow soldiers had made reports regarding concerns about his behavior, it was not the Army who discovered the extent of the threat Anderson actually posed. However, as a result of the investigation I was involved with, the Army was able to deal with the internal threat Anderson presented to the interests of the Army and his fellow soldiers before anyone was killed or otherwise put in harm's way. Whereas in the Hassan case, there appears to have been a multitude of reports made concerning his radical behaviors, but none of these supervising officials over Major Hassan apparently took any meaningful action to investigate him for any potential threats, which I believe enabled him to carry out the attacks that happened at Fort Hood. Also, like Major Hassan, Anderson repeatedly discussed his growing radicalized beliefs and hatred for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as his support for suicide bombings. Both Hassan and Anderson have been described as loners and social outcasts and had been denied promotions based on poor performance with their work within the Army. Also, both Anderson and Hassan both intended to take action against the Army in face of their pending deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, I also briefly mentioned that there was the case study and report that I consulted with the Department of Defense on. And this came about as a result of the Anderson case, as well as a couple other incidents. But the military, after that, recognized the need for more understanding of the radicalization process and the threat it presented. So in December of 2007, I consulted on this study through the Defense Department's Eurocom division regarding the radicalization process and how to identify individuals within the military that might be in the early stages of radicalization whose behavior is presenting red flags of an impending or escalating threat. The study was entitled The Radicalization of Members of the DoD and documented cases of soldiers who became radicalized and embraced the tenets of jihadist ideology and proceeded to commit crimes against the United States military under the umbrella of radical Islam. The study further contained findings and recommendations regarding how to identify and assess the potential or existence of any threat posed by radicalized individuals within the military whose behavior and actions presented red flags and constituting and making up for internal threats that might otherwise go unnoticed. I also have just briefly kind of touched on my belief that that the doctrine of political correctness was one factor that enabled and allowed Major Hassan's radicalization process, as well as laid the groundwork and landscape for him to carry out the Fort Hood attack successfully. But more than ever today, what we are witnessing as a result of political correctness is the downfall and almost demoralization of the American way of life. And this doctrine of political correctness has essentially really evolved into a dangerous and threatening multicultural doctrine, ideological doctrine, that has really infected and planted its tentacles in all levels of the U.S. government and American society. I believe an argument can be made that political correctness has enabled the social tolerance of hatred, violence, and extremist behavior when all practiced within the name of a religion, with this being almost an acceptable social norm that actually stands in dereliction of common sense and at the expense and safety of the American people. In the aftermath of the Fort Hood attack, what we have observed is the reality of the impact the culture of political correctness has wreaked within the military. We have also seen firsthand how the Obama administration and some Pentagon officials have attempted to color their own picture of the Fort Hood attack in terms that downplayed the seriousness of the threat that Major Hahn actually presented, as well as the Army's abject and negligent failure to protect the safety and security of those soldiers and civilians that were there that day and present at Fort Hood. The incident at Fort Hood was not a random act, I believe. It was not performed by a mentally ill person or the result of an individual operating under extreme duress who just snapped, as many of these news accounts attempt to report. What I do believe is the Fort Hood attack was a premeditated and carefully executed attack initiated by a radicalized Islamist acting under the umbrella of radical Islam. I really believe that what has happened to the U.S. government and Western society under the guise of political correctness is a process of what I've been referring to as reality engineering and almost a pandering to illusions of what the government and administration and the military would like the reality to be versus confronting the hard truths of what our reality really is. Mm-hmm. I honestly ask that the administration clarify exactly what their position would be regarding how they believe changing the name of the conflict of the war on terror to something as innocuous as an overseas contingency operation as if this somehow minimizes or diminishes the death-dealing and other horrors that terrorism actually represents. And lastly, I'd just like to conclude by saying that the American public must really decide which philosophy should be the guiding principle for the American people collectively under the form of their government. I ask, is it to be political correctness where the sensibilities of few dominate the well-being of the whole, or common sense where the greatest benefit for most people is the goal within the prescribed constraints of the Constitution? This political correct sickness that I refer to, I believe, has affected our government in such a way, and its tacit acceptance by society must be found as unacceptable and un-American. I believe that the only way we will get out of this political correct box is for the government and society at large to stand up and decry this nonsense and never look back. This right now concludes the comments that I was going to make, and I guess if time allows right now, we could go ahead and entertain questions.
Sure. Thanks for that breakdown, Shannon. I'd actually like to take the first question, and perhaps more of an observation, which is basically, it seems that much of what you're saying revolves around political correctness. In other words, it's not so much that we don't have the information to stave off this sort of terrorism and radicalization on American soil, but rather that it's a sort of self-crippling effect from political correctness. So being that that is the case, and this is something of a full question, and it's a long question, but just what thoughts do you have as the steps to begin to dismantle this kind of overbearing political correctness that just hampers all actions that can be taken from the U.S.?
Well, you know, it's a broad view that you can, ascribe to that. But the political correctness factor, I hadn't really strongly believed played that much of a role in things until after the Fort Hood incident, when they started coming out and, trying to color this picture of what they wanted the attack to represent. And, looking back, if you look over other incidents over the years since 9/11, we see a pattern of this, and it just keeps getting worse. I kind of refer to it as the reality engineering. What it's really doing is it's presenting an Achilles heel for us, and it's just opening us up for further attacks. And until people, say enough is enough, the political correctness factor is still going to guide a lot of these principles that government officials use in their application of their authorities and as well as performing their duties. So it's an ongoing process, but I do believe that it's one of those factors that's got to be examined, studied, and done away with. And, let's talk about common sense. That would take us a long way towards a better goal here.
Okay, great. Let's open the conference call to callers and have some questions. We have about 10 minutes left, and so I ask that the questions be direct, unlike mine, and if the response from Shannon can be as succinct as possible so we can take as many callers as possible.
Ladies and gentlemen, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad right now. I'll announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. Our first question comes from the line of Ms. Georgette Gelbard. Go ahead with your question, please.
Shannon, that was a very interesting discussion. Could you tell me whether you see a very big change between George Bush's administration and the current administration in terms of a deterioration in political correctness?
Well, certainly the Bush administration, practice in the political correctness field as well. I mean, and many of the administrations before that. But the differences with the Obama administration is really, we've kind of done almost a 360 in that, the Bush administration had more of a clearer vision, in my opinion, of what the threat represented and how to deal with it. And what I have seen and what I believe with the Obama administration is that they've really, really embraced political correctness as their enabler to accomplish the goals that they believe will, advance whatever it is that's on the table for, you know, being examined. But this reality engineering and calling things what they aren't, you know, in order to make, you know, the world in their eyes, you know, be what they would like it to be, is doing nothing for the American people and nothing for our image abroad. And I guess, you know, that would be the noticeable differences, at least in this respect.
Our next question comes from the line of Ms. Margot Einstein. Go ahead with your question, please.
Thank you very, very much. Since the Obama administration is not going to do anything, in fact, the opposite about political correctness, what can we personally do aside from strongly supporting Daniel Pipes?
Very good question. Well, you know, I think one good comparison might be to compare how the Tea Party movement has advanced and kind of set some of these, has really furthered, you know, their beliefs and the issues that the Tea Parties are furthering. And, you know, something like that in a grassroots effort could really go a long way towards, mm-hmm. you know, those of us just supporting those individuals who have, you know, respect within the field and community mm-hmm. To make sense of what is all involved. Mm-hmm. I guess that would be the shortest way to answer that.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Mr. Charles Solomon. Go ahead with your question, please.
Hello? Hello?
Yes?
Yes. I'm concerned about the lack of balance in the media. Just this very morning, CNN, around 9 o'clock, had the mentor of the five kids from Virginia who were going to do jihad in the Middle East, and he said they were all fun-loving boys, Americans, and the mosque is not the center of radicalization, but they get it from outside, and he just doesn't understand what this is all about. What bothers me is there's no one in rebuttal. How do we do something about that?
Well, the media is its own animal. And, you know, I would agree with your observations and your opinion in this regard. I don't know, other than, you know, there being something done in a grassroots type effort, as I referred to with the other caller's question, that really until something like a movement like that is started, we probably won't see any changes or move toward any changes anytime in the near future. I don't know how you make the media cooperate. Again, they're kind of pandering and playing into and advancing this whole reality engineering thing that has gone on with the Obama administration. Fox News, on the other hand, you know, I think they do a better job as far as bringing out both sides, but for whatever reasons, the other networks or news outlets don't seem to want to practice in that kind of fair playing field.
Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Our next question comes from the line of Mr. William Seltzer. Go ahead with your question, please.
I just don't really think that political correctness is a reality slogan that is going to help the situation. Of course it exists, and large part of it always exists so long as the terrorism or the acts are against someone or something you're for. And you can go so far, I've heard it applied to talk radio by liberals. You know. I just think you have to get mad enough or fear enough the consequences to take a very, very aggressive action. And no, we're not there yet. The administration doesn't really fear the Arab multitudes, and they don't fear that, of course, they don't want their soldiers killed. They don't want Americans killed, but not enough of them have been killed to alarm them. And I just don't have the confidence in attacking political correctness per se. It's a moving target. It doesn't mean anything really to me. That's just my response. I don't know. I don't mean to be critical in any way. You explained it quite well.
No, oh, sure. You know, I respect your opinion, and it's valuable to this whole discussion. I guess why I jumped on political correctness, as something to identify that, really stood out as a screaming red flag after the Fort Hood incident was because that was the first time for me it was just overly obvious what was being done as far as trying to, explain or justify or whatever, they were trying to make out of the Fort Hood.
I agree with that. I agree with you. I'm just
saying. I don't know how. I don't have the answer as to, how we really attack that in a sense. And you point out something, it's intangible and it's moving and fluid, and that's all very true. But nonetheless, it still is a crutch that's being used to advance a side of our society that is not reality. And I guess that would be my response to your question, but I certainly respect your opinion.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of General Paul Vallely. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yeah, Shannon, great overview and great details. So just a couple observations, and then I can tell you about the political correctness in Department of Defense. I did a radio interview shortly after the Fort Hood incidents, it's very apparent to me it would be tied to a mosque in a short period of time, and it was. Mm-hmm. The understanding that the outreach programs of the mosque, funded by the Wahhabis and the Saudis, and supportive organizations like CARE, is very substantiated, done by Steve Evermerson and the investigative report and many, many other data collections that have been done here and in Europe. So the mosques are a very important part of radicalization. The second extension of that is the radicalization within our prison systems today, particularly targeting the black prisoners. DOD has been plagued with the political correctness. Going back shortly after 9/11, I remember covering many of the stories and went on my trips to Baghdad and also at Department of Defense, that they never wanted to take on the ideology of radical Islam. Mm-hmm. And this has been very apparent in the policies and programs within the Department of Defense and what's passed down to our troops. So we've been plagued with that. I can remember Gordon England, Deputy Secretary of Defense, and the situation with Major Steve Coughlin, who tried to brief DOD on radical Islam, and basically Steve got fired in a contentious relationship with two Islamic officers that were hired in the Department of Defense. So it's real. It plagues the entire command and control within our forces, and the troops understand it very well. So I validated that on the ground and within the Department of Defense. But I don't really have a question, but I just wanted to support your what you're saying here. It's very valid.
Yeah, and absolutely, General. I mean, what you say brings some more another opinion with experience and credibility to the points that you make. And I mean, I guess what it is to me, it's something. It's got to be the straw that breaks the camel's back, and I've seen it, in my own dealings, but my dealings have primarily been with the intel agencies and other aspects in the larger intelligence community. But when I consulted with the DOD on this study I referred to, I was really excited that they were appearing to understand the importance of it, how to recognize it, so we could avoid situations like Fort Hood. And when Fort Hood happened and everything that fell out in the aftermath regarding Major Hassan, it's almost embarrassing.
It is. And Shannon, the other thing, General Casey's chief of staff, the Army's remark, that he's more concerned about the diversification And knowing General Casey, even when I met him in Baghdad, he still never had got a grip on what the ideology is and what the intent of radical Islam and the caliphate and Sharia law. They just don't understand, and they won't take the time to read and understand it. I can validate that.
Yeah.
And senior generals and admirals and policymakers just have not taken the time to understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, and the understanding is going to be one of the keys to us getting ahead in this war on terror. Otherwise, we're going to continue to be in this, in my opinion, vicious circle that we never get out, and it's counterproductive, and nothing ever is done towards an end goal. So, it's a Herculean task, but it's something that we can't avoid.
We do have two other callers in the queue. Mr. Abraham, do we have time to carry on?
If you can just let them know that it has to be really brief, because we're already, 1:32?
Yes. Okay, our next question comes from the line of Mr. David Kudish. Go ahead with your question, please, Mr. Kudish.
Yes, just as a very brief comment, a very famous anti-terrorist individual refers to this not as a war on terrorism, but a war against an ism. Instead of fascism or communism, it is radical Islamism. And when we say war on terror, we are making an error, falling into a trap of saying war against cold weather in Chicago or hot, humid weather in Miami. Please, please refer to it as a war on radical Islam.
Thank you. And our final question comes from the line of Ms. Pamela Rose. Go ahead with your question, please, Ms. Rose.
Hi, the question is, are you also focusing on sleeper cells as well? I've been focusing on the radicalization process. I'm concerned that there's already thousands of individuals just waiting for the appropriate time to expose themselves.
Yeah, that's definitely something that is... I've looked at that in over the years pretty extensively, and it's one of those kind of quiet elements that doesn't ever quite rise entirely to the top. But it's something that the danger with the sleeper cells is that they can lie dormant for such a long period of time that we almost get away from any thought that they might present an actual threat in reality. And the fact is I believe that they do, and we're going to see more of that. And what we've seen actually in the last 3 or 4 months is some of those bases is coming out with different individuals and some of these different terror plannings that have been talked about, especially since September.
Thank you, and there are no further questions.
Okay, great. Thanks to everyone for joining us today, and special thanks to you, Shannon, for joining us and sharing your time and insights. They were very helpful.
Thank you. I really appreciate the platform to be able to speak about the issue. Thank you very much.